The UN says that humanity stands on the brink of catastrophic man-made climate change. But is it true?
Not a chance. But we do stand on the brink of catastrophic government policies that threaten to ruin the nation our forefathers built and defended against tyranny.
So what drives the climate scare, Jay?
Besides simple ignorance, the scare is driven by corporate greed and the desire of government to control all aspects of our lives, Tom.
Is this part of something more sinister?
Indeed it is. Whether it's climate change or a pandemic or socialism, it really means sacrificing your rights and accepting the tyranny of the fourth branch of government, the bureaucracy. It must be stopped.
This is The Other Side of the Story with Dr. Jay Lair and Tom Harris of the International Climate Science Coalition.
Our guest this week is Edward J. Calabrese, professor of toxicology in the School of Public Health and Health Sciences at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. Dr. Calabrese has researched extensively in an area of host factors affecting susceptibility to pollutants and is the author of over 900 papers in scholarly journals. Oh, wow, 900, as well as more than 10 books. Dr. Calabrese was awarded the 2009 Marie Curie Prize for his work on hormesis, which pertains to the study of the benefits of exposure to phenomena such as radiation or mercury. He was the recipient of the International Society for Cell Communication and Signaling Springer Award for 2010. In 2013, Professor Calabrese was awarded an honorary doctorate of science from McMaster University in Hamilton, Ontario, which is actually my alma mater, so I'm very impressed with that. In 2014, he was awarded the Peter Beckman Award from Doctors for Disaster Preparedness. So welcome to the show, Professor Calabrese.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
Tom, I'm so excited to have Ed on the show. He and I go back a couple of decades that I became familiar with his work, and he's provided me with the honor sometimes of drafting brief articles from his lengthy scholarly articles for broader audiences. And Ed and I have gotten together in Boston many times on occasion of my wife running the Boston Marathon 9 years in a row. And if possible, Ed would come in, we'd have a meal together and catch up. But we shared something very similar in science, though our areas of expertise are very different. We have been attacked both for our positions in our science. Ed, as we'll be talking about, his position related to the impact of small amounts of radiation on the human body, and me, the impact of climate change on the Earth. I think we almost share the same bottom line. For 40 years, I've been trying to teach the world that man's impact on the thermostat of planet Earth is essentially zero. One side, as everybody knows, the alarmists say that we're having a negative effect. The Earth is warming and it's going to be the end of the Earth as we know it. The other side says, well, there's a little bit of an impact. It's small, but they worked feverishly to find a whole number, so many zeros to the right of the decimal point. It's insignificant. And I'm almost the only scientist on the planet that will say it's zero. It really is zero. If you can find a number, it's insignificant, and the default should be zero. And I think Ed feels the same way about a molecule or atom of radiation having a negative impact on the human body. And it is that belief by the rest of the scientific community, or much of it, that there is no threshold. The LNT that he'll describe stands for no nuclear threshold. And in other words, they're believing that a single atom of radiation could cause cancer. It not only cannot cause cancer. It has beneficial effects throughout medicine. And Ed, we had the pleasure last week of having a scientist, a nuclear physicist from South Africa, Kelvin Kemp, on our show. And he described something that neither Tom or I were aware of, but that South Africa is one of the largest exporters of nuclear medicine in the world, that they have planes carrying nuclear medicine all over the world, literally every hour of the day, 24/7. It was fantastic to learn that. So let me start you off, Ed, by explaining to our audience what the linear no threshold, or LNT, is and how you came to suspect it was not appropriate to use in nuclear radiation and began to investigate all the people involved in what certainly has become one of the biggest frauds in medicine ever perpetrated.
Thanks very much, Jay. Thanks very much, Tom. Greatly appreciate being here. The linear non-threshold dose response relationship, it's part of a family of dose response relationships. It's kind of scientists' attempt to try to figure out how agents affect biological systems and what relationship an exposure has to a response. I think most people are very familiar with something called a threshold dose response. So say, for example, that you like to drink a glass of wine. And let's say you might have three glasses of wine. And for me, I would begin to feel lightheaded and high, you know, after perhaps a glass of wine, but not after a sip or two. I would need more than that. I would have to cross a certain line or a certain threshold before I would begin to sense that lightheadedness. And so within that context, you can see that a certain amount of alcohol in this particular case is needed before you actually feel a biological effect. And so therefore we call it, you have to pass a threshold. You have a threshold dose response model. However, in great contrast to that, we have a linear dose response model. The linear dose response model literally means that there is a direct relationship between the exposure you have and the response, and it's directly a one-to-one relationship. That means that if an agent causes cancer at some level, then you can actually bring it down to a single molecule could start the process. So in the case of a chemical or a human, let's say carcinogen, let's say smoking cigarettes, people generally recognize that smoking cigarettes is a cause of human lung cancer. And so one could throw out to you, well, what about if I only smoked one cigarette? Would one cigarette increase my risk of developing lung cancer? And the LNT says, yes, one cigarette would do this. But what about if I only puffed in once? Yes, the LNT would actually claim that your risk goes up with that. What about if I was just in the room with somebody who smoked and just puffed once? Would my risk increase? And you can see how this goes down to a ridiculous relationship, such that there is a risk that never goes away. It never goes away unless there is never any exposure there. And so the LNT brings us into kind of the realm of the absurd. And this is where our regulatory agencies have taken us, really into the realm of the absurd. Even, for example, when you take a look at powerful chemical carcinogens in drinking water, even at the level where the EPA estimates a risk of one cancer per million people over the course of a 70 or 80 year lifespan, if you look at the number of molecules that are in a liter of drinking water at approximately that risk of one in a million, even a powerful carcinogen, you'd have about 10 trillion molecules. And those 10 trillion, you would have to drink 2 liters of water a day, every single day for your whole 70 or 80 years to give you a risk of one in a million. And yet there's 10 trillion molecules there. And And however one wants to look at this LNT model and why it's been ever embraced by regulatory agencies is really something for clinical psychiatrists.
Yeah, exactly. Why do you think they do this? I mean, are they just not properly educated in the field to understand that there is a threshold below which radiation is not only not dangerous, it's actually good for you?
That's a good question. I think that one has to separate intelligence from decision making. I believe that if one were to take a look at human behavior and how decisions are made, there's really a separation between intelligence and emotion. And I think that when one comes down to trying to look at how could a regulatory agency come up with an LNT, how could this actually happen? Because it actually isn't very rational. And you have very smart people who would fight you to the death over this particular thing. And you have to wonder, you know, what's going on here? And I think it enters the realm of politics and ideology, and these get confused, and it becomes confused with science, and in the case of human behavior as well, you can very easily manipulate people into becoming very fearful, and mm-hmm. I think if you play, you know. What's the greatest emotion, I think, in humans? It's really fear. And it's so easy to play on people's fear and then bury things within a flowery quasi-scientific framework. But when you peel away the layers of the onion, you realize that argument for LNT is pretty... It's pretty much non-existent scientifically, and from a historical point of view, it's really based on mistakes and fraud and scientific misrepresentations.
Ed, you have just described what has been going on for 30 years, certainly in the climate change arena. Everything you said, the fear that has supported a technical idea about a single molecule of radiation producing cancer is the same level of fraud and fear and psychosis that has been supported by the climate change people. The LNT theory is really the root behind the fact that the cost of our nuclear power plants has tripled because of the requirement of safety protocols that are entirely unnecessary.
I'll have to share with you one more thing that they share in common, and that is the manipulation of the academic community to promote these. And that is that what you have, academics live off of federal grants. I'm one of them. I've been at UMass for 45 years. This is my 91st semester at the University of Massachusetts, and I'm more or less very proud to say I've been funded by federal dollars essentially all 45 years. I've been a very successful grants person here at UMass, okay? But if I wasn't successful, if others weren't successful, you wouldn't really have your job. You wouldn't have your laboratory. You really wouldn't play this game very, very long and very well. It's not just publish or perish. It's really bring in sizable grants with sizable overhead to the university. And now, how do you do that? Basically, you do that in different ways. I'll give you an example. Back in the 1950s, when the LNT model first became established within the U.S. government, I have copies of letters by the National Academy of Sciences members who were making the recommendation, and that they claimed that it wouldn't be a bad thing to exaggerate, to overstate the risk, because what that did is to basically get the public frightened, get the officials, the elected officials frightened. And what that means is that more money would flow towards the research community, towards them. I have this in writing from multiple people, and you can see it It's just a legacy that's passed on, is that if you exaggerate the risks, you get people frightened. You'll have resources, more resources directed towards those questions, and your chances of getting tenure and success are greatly increased. There's a lot.
Well, Ed, you said something that really surprised me. I would assume that the grant proposals you have written over and over again indicate that you'd like to show that the linear, the LNT is not correct. You're trying to prove the opposite, and they're still giving you money to do it. In the climate change area, I can guarantee you, if you write a proposal that hints at the idea that you may reduce the belief that man is responsible for the temperature of our planet in any way, you have zero chance of getting a dollar. So how did you go about paddling upstream and getting money to prove what the government doesn't support?
Well, actually, and this is interesting, I really wasn't funded to take a look at LNT. It just so happens that when I started, kind of led me into looking at LNT. But what my research actually does, Jay, is I was looking at this hormesis issue, and I was looking at how you can find ways to increase the adaptive response in cells and in individuals so that you can protect yourself against harmful things. So my research would take a look at how can you slow down the rate of aging? How can you protect whatever neurons you have left in your brain? How can you protect your eyes from changes in visual acuity? How can you enhance your decision making? That's actually where my research goes, and it's really taking a look at how low doses of various types of agents, sometimes stressor agents and others, how they can actually increase the capacity to perform and to protect. And in the course of that, I actually learned that low doses of radiation, they instead of being harmful, they actually could be used to upregulate a whole spectrum of adaptive responses and then be used to protect yourself against high dose of radiation or lots of other things. And so, and right within the context of my own research, I saw the fallacy of the LNT argument.
All right, now then, in other words, the government has not punished you for all the other publications that you've had on the LNT going against the rules of EPA and others. So you're very fortunate. Those of us in the climate change area who are considered, deniers of the man-caused global warming generally are punished entirely and have very little hope of being funded. I have not applied in a long time, so I can't say it in my case, but I know that with many books I've written and grants on any number of environmental issues where fear was unwarranted, I definitely was punished. I won't go into the details, but I have definitely, over the course of my career, been punished for my beliefs that man has virtually nothing whatsoever to do with determining the temperature of our planet.
See, it's quite different for me. I'd have to say I was one of these academics for 25 years who really strongly supported LNT. All my first, that we said, I had like 10 books and so forth, maybe more these days. All my initial books all supported LNT. I was on all these National Academy of Sciences committees that supported LNT. And then what happened is I got into this hormesis area and started looking at adaptive responses, but I still didn't directly challenge LNT. And then for me, back in probably 15 to 18 years after some really intensive research on this, I decided to write a review paper on the history of the dose response and where they all came from. And it brought me back to the late 1800s and brought it up to the present with this review. But in the course of that, I was told that I really needed to explore the life and times of of this guy, Nobel Prize winner, Herman Muller, who got the Nobel Prize for being the first to induce what he thought were gene mutations. And my review paper had not adequately addressed him. And so I put the paper aside and did a big, deep dive into who this man was, all his research and so forth. And it led to all these heretofore, you know, historical discoveries that eviscerated the whole history of LNT. Showing Muller's deceptiveness and lying in his Nobel Prize, making up data in the Manhattan Project to try to establish LNT relationships, National Academy of Sciences committees on lying and deceiving, committing scientific misconduct. All this is the basis for our work. But I didn't get into that because it was my goal. I kind of fell over it. And then by falling into it, one discovery led to another, and the whole thing exploded.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one question that I'm sure people are wondering is, what would be an example of low-level radiation that we experience all the time? For example, would a granite tabletop in a kitchen, would that be emitting radiation, and is that a problem?
I eat a banana every day. It's loaded with certain types of radiation. I mean, everything that you really touch has some. I mean, just standing outside, you will get some background level of, you know, cosmic radiation and terrestrial radiation. It's ever present at certain levels.
And those levels are obviously not in any way bad for you.
It depends on if you were to ascribe to the linear non-threshold model. Yes, you would claim that there's background radiation that's harmful for you. Absolutely, you would claim that it was it would be totally consistent with what they would claim. And I would say that that's going to be, to me, that's what I'm challenging.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if my awareness of the LNT could even being not correct, could even have preceded you, because, oh my goodness, it's got to be close to 40 years ago that I read a 1,000-page book on hormesis by Walter Hybe. And I'm wondering if he published before you came to your awakening some 20 years ago.
Well, you know, it's interesting that you bring on the history of this, because my first take on hormesis, I didn't even know the term. It was back in 1966, and I was an undergraduate in college taking a plant physiology class, and when we were just treating plants with a synthetic growth inhibitor to just show how we would have dose response relationship, and the plants would grow less the more they were exposed to this inhibitor, and our plants were stimulated. And the professor, he couldn't figure it out, and he came in and said, "I don't know what's going on with this study, but you guys are supposed to have an inhibition, and you're getting a stimulation. Can you come back and try to look at this?" He said, "Because either you use the wrong chemical, or maybe you've discovered something new. I don't know." And wow. I was the only one who went back, and then we determined that I had given, actually, when I made up the stock solution, I made it up incorrectly and gave the plants about tenfold less concentrated version of that synthetic growth inhibitor. And when we did the experiment all over again, the way he said and the way I did it, we got a low dose stimulation and a high dose inhibition. And then this guy was a very stickler. He made me reproduce that study about, you know, 10 or 12 times before he would agree to it. And then that was all done in soil. Then I did the whole thing over in hydroponics and in solution, got the same results. And we published the paper. We didn't call it hormesis because I didn't even know the term then. We just said it was a low dose stimulation and a high dose inhibition. And that was back in the late 60s, early 70s. And it wasn't until 1985 that the Electric Power Research Institute decided to have a conference on radiation hormesis. And it was really based upon the 1980 book by Tom Lucky that got everybody all excited, in which he claimed that low-dose radiation actually could be beneficial and that the regulatory agencies needed to, you know, basically smell some smelling salts because they were going in the wrong direction.
So hormesis, once again, is the beneficial impact of low levels of something, which at high levels are dangerous. So that's what hormesis is?
I think that's a good way to say it, Tom. I think that that really encapsulates it pretty darn well. Yeah, and that applies not just to radiation. It applies to everything in life. It applies to all sorts of chemicals. It applies to the way you live your life. I mean, there's an optimal amount of exercise, and then there's too much exercise. There's an optimal amount of oxygen and too much oxygen. There's an optimal amount of sleep, and then there's then too much sleep is not good for you. So this biphasic dose response cuts into everything.
Yeah, I guess it would apply to vitamins and minerals as well, wouldn't it?
It does. I look at hormesis a little bit differently because hormesis, I'm looking at it as also effective when you have things that aren't necessary or not essential. So if you were to take a look at even agents like Jay mentioned it in the beginning, mercury being showing a hormetic dose response, even the most toxic substances that we know of, things for example like methyl mercury and nervous system. One has to worry about this, pregnant women and so forth, and stay away from, you know, fish like tuna and so forth during the pregnancy. And those are probably all good recommendations. But I would say that I have about a dozen, maybe two dozen, actually, very excellent studies with methyl mercury, with neuronal systems that show low doses being beneficial and high doses being inhibitory. Even the most toxic thing that you've heard of, the chemical called ricin, which had been sent to different types of political figures by various people who wanted to do them in, a very, very powerfully toxic agent. And if you look at the ricin literature, you'll find that it also is hormetic. It actually has beneficial effects at low doses. In this case, it's very low doses. But I think everything at low doses actually shows this hormetic dose response relationship.
Well, wow. Did you, when I read all 1,000 pages rapidly of Walter Hybe's book, I don't know, the title might have been Hormesis. He, you know, went through hundreds and hundreds of things that were hormetic. The book was, might have been self-published. There was a strange thing about it. I actually did talk to him, and he was so crazy about hormesis that it kind of got me that he almost went too far with it. Did you ever have any contact with him or his book?
Yeah, I did. In fact, you can't see it here, but it's in this office. I have it. I have it on a bookshelf. I've read it, and I did communicate with him in the past. Yes.
Can we go back to Professor Muller and exactly what happened with the Nobel Prize winning and his cheating? Like, what actually went on there?
Boy, Muller's an interesting character. Muller was a great, great scientist, and he was a great geneticist, a very, very bright man. I'll give him all his due. He's also very ambitious, and he had a series of what I think character flaws. And he's a very he could be, if you were on his side, he could be a great friend. If he opposed you, he could be a very, very powerful, mean, and very, a very tough enemy, and wouldn't mind cutting you off at the knees at all. So he's a very, very tough guy. Ambitious, all tied into his ambition. And what happened was that Muller, back when he was young, he was really trying to be the first to discover mutation, not because of cancer risk assessment and EPA that wouldn't be created for 50 years. He was really trying to figure out the answer to the mechanism of biological evolution. And he knew that it had to tie into being some way that the genes had to become altered by factors in the environment to be able to explain Darwin's evolution, origin of the species, and Gregor Mendel's work tied into to genetic distribution of genes within the population. But you needed an evolutionary mechanism, and it had to be mutation. But who could actually do this? And they tried like crazy. This is from around 1911 to 1926 to induce gene mutation. And they threw everything except the kitchen sink at the little Drosophila fruit flies they were working with, and including ionizing radiation using X-rays. They used radon. They used lead and mercury, formaldehyde. They threw everything at these animals. They raised the temperature high. They put the temperature low, and they could not induce mutation. They walked away from a lot of that work saying, "God, our genetic." Our genome is very, very robust and strong and it's protected. And it was, but they still knew that you had to be able to cause mutation. And in 1926, in the fall of 1926 at the University of Texas at Austin, Muller had his breakthrough. He manipulated in a positive way the fruit flies that he was working with and made them more susceptible to inducing chromosomal change, and at doses that were extremely high, he was able to induce changes such that he saw what I'm going to call our changes in the next generation. They call those phenotypic changes, that things that you could observe. For example, when he treated his males in one generation, he saw offspring that had a change in color, or the antenna was a little bit shorter or longer, or something happened to the wing. And those would be like phenotypic things you can see changes. And Muller confused an observation, a phenotypic change, with a mechanism. He thought that he had induced gene mutation. And I have to tell you, if you go back in and you dig out Muller's work, the doses that he was working with when he induced those quote-unquote mutations, it was 95 million times, and I mean million, with six zeros and 95 before it, 95 million times greater than background. Massively high dose. Most of the animals that he was working with, they were sterilized. They were very resistant to radiation, but killed many of them, sterilized the vast majority of them. And that's what he was actually working with. And that's where he saw his change. Now, he didn't know this because anybody claims that he has induced gene mutation. He called his study the artificial transmutation of the gene, okay, of the gene. And as it turns out, when he publishes his paper in the top journal in the world, which is Science Journal, he publishes it, and he doesn't show any data. He shows no data whatsoever in this most significant of articles. And as it turns out, his best friend and others, they believe that at the doses he was giving, he must have been, how did he know he wasn't punching big holes in the chromosomes? And that wouldn't be such a major discovery. And so this became a very big point with Muller over the next 20 years, got in many disputes with others, and fought back to try to sustain his argument. Just think of a person such as Muller. He basically publishes a paper because he wants to be first, because to be first means you might get the Nobel Prize. So he uses a personal connection to the editor of the journal Science to get a paper published in Science with no data. Then he goes to the 5th International Genetics Congress over in Berlin that fall to show his data. Now he shows his data, and it shows these phenotypic changes, but he doesn't submit his paper to a peer review publication. He publishes his paper in a conference proceeding, but the paper lacks no references. He has no references whatsoever. He doesn't include in his paper his methods and materials for how he did what he did. And that becomes the basis of his Nobel Prize.
I had the good fortune of reviewing your paper, and I remember in my review I said it really reads like a mystery novel. It was awesome. Well, I think that's a good place to take our break. And let's come back after the break and talk a little more about the effect of nuclear power and nuclear medicine if we could get rid of the LNT.
Each Each of us is born with 30 trillion cells that make us. These cells determine how we feel, perform, sleep, focus, and how long we live. And to live our best life, all we have to do is feed our cells. But most food and supplements don't reach our cells, keeping us from reaching our full potential. Make every cell count with Healthy Cell. Founded with a mission to empower people to take control of their own health at the most fundamental level, Dr. Vincent Giampapa, world-renowned cell researcher and medical doctor, created supplements that work at the cellular level to boost immune health, sleep better, focus deeper, and stay younger longer. Go to HealthyCell.com and use code OUTLOUD for 20% off your first order of any product. And that's HealthyCell.com, HealthyCell, and use code OUTLOUD for 20% off.
Today, America stands at the crossroads of history. Our actions will determine the fate of our nation. Well, that journey starts here and starts now. We invite you to join us in making the ultimate difference. Subscribe to our podcast and newsletters. Turn notifications on and stay in the know. You'll find all that back at AmericaOutLoud.com. Liberty and justice for all.
Professor Calabrese, what was it that actually changed the genetic structure of the fruit flies? Was it the high level of radiation?
Back in that era, too, with improvements in with cytogenetics, looking under a microscope, or in the modern era where you could do nucleotide analyses, what actually has been shown is that Mueller actually did not induce gene mutation. Mueller actually induced massive gene deletions. It was the equivalent of taking a molecular bazooka and shooting it at the chromosomes, and it just knocking out thousands, tens of thousands of nucleotides, just blasting it out. And then the chromosome material has a tendency to recombine. And when it recombines, if those fruit flies survive and go to the next generation, you may see like a new gene or a new characteristic shows up. Mueller was confusing that with wow, I think I induced a gene mutation. And the funny part in the science paper is that he refers to his genetic changes as point mutations. He had no idea what the hell was going on. And yet, because he was so feisty and so argumentative, and he was really probably the smartest guy in the room. I mean, he's a very bright man. I don't want to say that he wasn't. He certainly was. That people, people don't want to challenge the expert. They think, well, God, he was the first one to induce these changes. He's a geneticist. He's been at it for so long. Plus, I'm afraid of him because he might chop my head off anyways, because he can be a pretty tough guy in debate. That you just kind of listen to him, and his view became persuasive. And if it wasn't persuasive, then he probably would beat you up or threaten to beat you up intellectually anyways. And Mueller, and he plus aggressive, and he was desiring to get that prize, and nothing would get in the way of getting that prize. And then at the same time, Mueller had developed a view of trying to protect especially pregnant women from being exposed to high levels of X-rays medically, and applied his linear theory to protecting developing fetuses and protecting others. And so he developed, tied in beyond his evolutionary ideas, he then developed a I call medical public health perspective that then began to take over, and that's what we're coping with today.
All of your papers, which I have read, the case you make against him and all the bad science that he did, the underhanded things he did, you have so much evidence. It's so persuasive. How has it been that you've been unable to get the EPA and other government agencies involved in medicine to begin looking at getting rid of the LNT?
I have to think that there's a fair amount of brainwashing that has gone on, not just within EPA, but really the entire biomedical establishment. And I'd have to say that I was brainwashed at the same time. It's not that, you know, there's a cult that's out there, and the real cult, it goes back before Mueller, and it was really the cult of dose response and how it all came to be. And this is really weird to even bring this up, but it really was a battle back in the late 1800s in Europe and in this country between what we call traditional medicine, big power medicine today, and homeopathy. But back in the 1870s and 80s or so, homeopathy was fairly powerful. And so equally powerful, maybe more powerful than what we call traditional medicine today. In the U.S., the AMA was created just to counter the impact of homeopathy. But what happened in the 1880s is that a researcher in Germany by the name of Hugo Schultz discovers this biphasic dose response. He's studying chemical disinfectants, trying to come up with a better way to disinfect for surgical operations and things of that nature. And he's treating with mercury and formaldehyde and all these other things that are very toxic. And he thinks that they're going to have a linear dose response, right? But when he exposes his yeast, like brewer's yeast, to these chemicals at widely ranging doses, yeah, at high doses they were harmful and they killed the yeast and so forth. But at low doses, each one of them, they stimulated the growth of the yeast. They enhanced their metabolism. They were beneficial to the yeast. And without going into all the details that were part of the story, the bottom line was that this Hugo Schultz and one of his colleagues, they made the decision that they had discovered the explanatory principle of homeopathy. Huh. And what happened at that point was that Hugo Schultz became basically persona non grata, almost kicked out of his medical school, got the traditional medical faculty to marginalize him and his ideas as much as possible. But homeopathy staked out, you know, they were the first ones that staked out a dose response, and that dose response was the biphasic dose response, and Schultz named it after himself. It was called the Arndt-Schultz Law, which eventually, 50 years later, gets renamed hormesis in 1943 by some U.S. scientists. But what happened is that the British medical community, led by the pharmacologists in the first and second decades of the 20th century, they basically did their very best to destroy homeopathy and to destroy the career of Schultz. And they were very successful. In the U.S. in 1900, there were 23 homeopathic medical schools. By the year 1920, there were three. Without question, traditional medicine grew in great power, and homeopathy, you know, essentially regressed with respect to their influence. But what happened is that the traditional medicine had needed a dose response, and they developed they accepted after a while the threshold model. And in the late 1920s, early 1930s, Mueller came to challenge them. At least with respect to mutation, and said, no, the threshold model works for other things, but for mutation and radiation, it's the linear dose response. There is no safe level. And that all happened, that transition happened in 1930, and nobody really listened to Mueller. And he was on the outside, and he fought but he had a group of radiation geneticists who were smart and like him, and they viewed him as their leader, and they wanted to get this linear model adopted, whether it was to promote their career or to save humanity, however one wants to look at it, or a combination of both, and they would do anything to do it. And that is, they would lie, they would misrepresent, they would cover up, they would do any. And the papers that I've written really lay out exactly what these people did. And these were the big time leaders in this country. People get mm-hmm. Nobel Prize winners. Yeah.
Well, we'll actually include links to your papers under the podcast when it goes up on Monday. Sounds like it's really a form of bullying that's going on. I mean, science is supposed to be self-correcting, but it sounds like person like Mueller can be pretty intimidating to a junior scientist.
It'd be very interesting to go back and take a look at, have a program on this, on the Manhattan Project. Because we think of the Manhattan Project as you know, as a project that produced the bomb. And we have Robert Oppenheimer and the making of the atomic bomb and the great book that was written by Richard Rhodes that, you know, won the Pulitzer Prize and so forth. It's you can watch, you know, listen to the, you know, the whole program on YouTube and so forth. But there's a whole other aspect to the Manhattan Project, and that other aspect of the Manhattan Project is what LNT is all about. It's like a forgotten story. It's like a bunch of money was given by the Atomic Energy Commission, and it was given to the University of Rochester to try to figure out the genetic effects of radionuclides and radiation in general. Well, they knew there was going to be a nuclear industry after the war, and they wanted to figure out how to protect workers and other considerations, maybe even environmental considerations, but they had to understand the biological effects of this. And as it turns out, the leader of that research in the University of Rochester just happened to be a close associate of Mueller. His name was Kurt Stern, and Mueller was a professor at in my town, not at my university, but at Amherst College, literally 1 mile from where I'm sitting right now. And so once he got the contract in 1943, Mueller became a paid consultant to the University of Rochester through the Atomic Energy Commission, and became a very outstanding consultant, because I got copies of their entire correspondence over all these years, and way before that and way after that, for that matter, and could see how those studies emerged. But the studies from the Manhattan Project became the basis for LNT, and it came right out of Stern and Mueller's bailiwick. And it was within the Manhattan Project that the major first steps towards what I'm going to call scientific abuse, dishonesty, scientific misconduct actually emerged. We mentioned Mueller's Nobel Prize, where I said that he was dishonest in his Nobel Prize. Well, the big study that was going on that was done showed literally a threshold dose response. It did not support a linear dose response that Stern and Mueller and their whole group really wanted and really demanded. And I got to see all the data. I got to see all the correspondence and how they tried to deal with it and how they tried to actually cover it up. But I knew that when Mueller went to the Nobel Prize, to give his Nobel Prize lecture, and he gave it on December 12, 1946, over in Stockholm, and Mueller goes and he gives this lecture, and he basically just destroys the threshold model, then advocates that it should be switched over to LNT, and I'm reading this and I'm saying, well, God, how could Mueller have ever said that if he had seen the data? He was part of the study. I said, well, maybe Mueller didn't see the data. Sometimes consultants don't see everything. So that's when I really got all their correspondence. And then I realized that on November 6th of 1946, Stern sent Mueller the entire database, the paper, everything laying out the challenge to LNT and what were they going to do. And I have the letter November 12th. Back to Stern, in which Mueller says, oh, God, this is a real serious problem. What are we going to do? This guy, the researcher was a good researcher, but this is a real problem. You have to get more money from the government and test this thing out. But this is a serious problem, because this was the biggest and best study to date. It was the gold standard. But when Mueller goes 1 month later and speaks in Stockholm, what does he say? Mueller doesn't share any of this information. Mueller goes and says, there is no possibility for there being a threshold. When he's just seen the best study to date supports a threshold, and in writing he's saying, oh God, we got to replicate this study. We have to do this and that. And it just goes downhill from there on. How could somebody who's going to get a Nobel Prize go over to Stockholm and mislead the entire world? And Herman did it.
That, you know, it's exactly what's been going on for 30 years in climate change. We have people in the field that have made huge reputations just lying and lying. And if you challenge them, they sue you. It's amazing. It's really sad of what's happened in science. And I've studied it historically, not only your work, but it really does begin with the Manhattan Project and the success of the atomic bomb. Under Eisenhower, his science director was a fellow by the name of Vannevar Bush. And he was just so enthralled with the success of this group of scientists working under government funding in the bowels of the, I guess it was the University of Chicago, developing the atomic bomb. It was so successful that he felt that better research would be done were it all under the guidance of the government. And that was really the beginning of the power that the government took over so much research from private industry and the funding that you described earlier in the program, really controlling so much of what scientists do. And it certainly has totally controlled climate science. You cannot get any money to study the fact that man has little or no impact. You get all the money in the world by saying that you can show even more evidence that man's activities control the thermostat of the planet. It's very sad what has happened to science, but you're giving a magnificent example of how this type of fraud began so big time in science.
Well, you know, it gets worse when the National Academy decides to say that they're going to challenge the threshold model. And they pick a jury of 12 geneticists, all of them card-carrying members of the LNT party. And those are the only ones who get to be on the National Academy of Sciences, right? And that they're all funded by the Rockefeller Foundation. And then the Rockefeller Foundation, it's very interesting. The president of the Rockefeller Institute for Medical Sciences, that becomes Rockefeller University, the president of that organization was also the president of the National Academy of Sciences at the time, was also on the Rockefeller Foundation board. They had been funding Mueller and all these other geneticists over the years. They knew exactly what they believed and what they didn't believe. They handpicked a jury to get exactly what they wanted. And in the course of the comments, because I have all the transcripts and everything, the person in charge of the panel, who is the director of research for the Rockefeller Foundation, makes the equivalent of a bribe, saying, if we get the report that we want, you'll have essentially a lot of free money for radiation geneticists to do what you want to do. Holding the carrot in front of these people, the handpicked jury. And it just gets worse. The more you know, it just gets worse. And with all the details that have been released in the last, you know, 4 or 5 years.
Mm-hmm. So as our audience can understand some of the sequence of events, in comparison with Mueller's work, when was it understood that low levels of radiation from Hiroshima and Nagasaki actually showed beneficial development? I mean, when did that actually come about? When did they learn that?
I think it's being learned all the time, actually. This is kind of a weird circumstance. First, the evidence that I'll say, at least with respect to mutation, that low levels of radiation could induce adaptive responses was in 1984. So that's about 40 years ago. And that was with the creation of something called the adaptive response. It's just been expanded tremendously for all kinds of radiation, on many different kinds of endpoints and so forth. But it's interesting to note that even this past year, I had a couple of papers written on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, going back to the 1950s and carrying it forward, and where people had reported that the only dose response was linear for the first cancer, which was leukemia. When I went back in and I dug out all the original data, the actual dose responses were, guess what? They were J-shaped. They were showing a beneficial effect at low doses as you got kind of further away from the epicenter where the bomb was dropped. This is totally new. The data were there for anybody to see. But people, you know, they have blinders on. So it's 2021 when this stuff is even coming out now. The unveiling of beneficial effects of lower dose radiation, you know, has a It has a long history, but sometimes it becomes inverted, like correct the mistakes of these earlier analyses. And yet they were so blinded by their ideologies that they couldn't see a J-shaped curve or a Hermetic curve if it was staring them in the face. Mm-hmm. All they could see is they can just see linearity. You know, they're blind. They're actually blinded. And I think that's because they live in a cult. Brainwashed, and they happen to be smart people that are brainwashed.
What kind of beneficial effects would we have seen from Hirosha? Was it that they had less cancers in following generations? Like, what were the kinds of benefits?
I looked at leukemia. They actually had less leukemia, lower doses. That it's surprisingly, but they had lower. They had in the lower dose range. They had less than the background, less than the control group. People would think that I was crazy, but I just kind of followed the data. I was shocked to see it myself, and it wasn't that I set out to prove that, but I somehow uncovered that relationship. But also a very important thing for you to know and for the listeners to know, and that was that all kinds of studies have been done on the survivors and the children of survivors of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. But from 1945, after the bomb was dropped, to 1955, first 10 years, people were studying 75,000 offspring of people, adults who had children who had been exposed, to the bomb. And everybody thought that these children would be born with all kinds of birth defects, three eyes and, three ears and whatever else, and all kinds of subtle defects and so forth. And when they studied them, they found no significant treatment-related effects, none. And this was following 75,000 people, major scientists from Japan and the United States. And by the way, this study has gone all the way to the present time, and they still have not found any significant genetic effects in the children of the survivors who were exposed to the bombing in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Despite all those negative effects, the director of that study, who was also part of the National Academy of Sciences Committee, when they met for the first time in 1955 to try to make some recommendations to the country on the health effects of low-dose radiation and the like, he gave them their 300-page study that showed no significant treatment effects, right, on mutation and birth defects. The committee that was led by Herman Muller, Muller stands up in the meeting and Muller decides that study should not be given scientific standing. It's a major international study led by one of their own committee members, and the U.S. National Academy of Sciences Committee decided not to even evaluate it, but to go back to use only the invalid fruit fly studies that were coming out of that came out of the Manhattan Project 10 years before. The director of that study snuck that study over to the British. They had a parallel genetics committee, and that group endorsed that study, and it had a profoundly different impact where they were very threshold-like in their evaluation and not supporting a linear dose response. It was, to me, this is like an extremely embarrassing moment in the history of the National Academy of Sciences, and nobody really knew this. I've been in this for a long time, and I only discovered this 18 months ago. I don't think anybody was even aware of it. This is like a major scandal.
We have to wrap up there. That was an amazing interview, Dr. Calabrese.